One never knows what Congress is going to do, of course, but we'll lay out some options for them and the corporate tax code as they try to get this thing done. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 5th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We're going to start with a bit more on taxes today, the corporate side of the equation. We did individuals yesterday. We're going to look at some of the differences House and Senate negotiators are going to have to bridge as they work this through. First, though, a global economy perspective. One of the arguments that Republicans are making for their tax plan, the argument really, is that cutting corporate taxes is going to make the American economy more competitive, that this will be a more attractive place for big multinationals to invest. We had Marketplace's Kimberly Adams look into that.
The basic argument goes something like this. Right now, the U.S. has the highest corporate tax rate among developed countries, although most companies don't pay that full rate. Under the Republican plan, says Jonathan Traub of the Tax Policy Group at Deloitte,
it lowers our corporate tax rate to 20%. It creates a territorial tax regime, both of which should make the U.S. a more competitive place to invest and grow.
Shifting to a territorial system puts the U.S. in line with other countries. Companies pay taxes on profits based on where they earn them instead of in their country of origin. And the lower rate could lure more investment here as part of other considerations.
In the short term, it could mean that more companies bring back money they have parked abroad in low tax jurisdictions. It could mean that companies have more money to spend.
Virginia Hoffler researches transnational corporations at the University of Maryland, College Park.
It could also mean that companies pay out big dividends to their shareholders instead of investing in new technology and upgrading their workforce skills.
And if that happens, she says, the U.S. looks a lot less attractive as a place to invest. Taxes are part of a larger picture of what companies consider. William Lee is with the Milken Institute, which ranks countries based on a variety of factors tied to competitiveness.
The key to having a good position and good investment opportunities in the United States is, number one, lowering the tax rate, but number two, the right regulatory environment.
Regulations, education, infrastructure all factor into how competitive a country looks in the global marketplace. And what's important often depends on what the industry is and how badly they want to be here. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We know the corporate tax rate is going down from 35% to 20%-ish. It's still technically up in the air. The real question, though, is when. The House says 2018. The Senate says 2019. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra explains what a difference a year makes.
The Senate tax bill puts off its cut to the corporate tax rate because, well, lawmakers needed the money. Under Senate rules, there's a limit to how much the tax bill can increase the deficit. Terrence Corvat teaches at George Mason University's Scalia Law School.
If you delay the tax cut by 1 year, you get to raise corporate tax revenues for another year, which gives them some freedom.
Delaying the cut saves $100 billion. So you might be wondering, why doesn't the House GOP just agree to a 2019 phase-in? It's only a year. One reason? There's a midterm election in 2018. And the thing is, Republicans say cutting corporate taxes is how they'll stimulate the economy. So Reuven Aviona from the University of Michigan Law School says if that cut gets delayed,
the fear is, I think, that the effects will not be felt sufficiently by taxpayers or by voters, and therefore, you know, they might lose the election.
The other risk is that if this cut is put off, it might never happen. Robert Hockett teaches at Cornell Law School.
One of the arguments is that if the Democrats retake the Congress during the midterms, they might simply cut off the cuts themselves at the pass before they've kicked in. They'll simply delay or actually just repeal those particular cuts.
Even if President Trump uses his veto power to prevent a delay or repeal, the corporate tax rate cut could become a Democratic bargaining chip in all kinds of legislative debates. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
As I said yesterday, we did individual taxes and the differences between the House and Senate bills, one item of which is the individual AMT, the alternative minimum tax. There is a corporate AMT as well, and guess what? Companies don't like it, and Congress is going to have to figure out how it feels. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
Right now, corporations pay a top tax rate of 35%, but they can reduce that with all sorts of credits and deductions. Ed McCaffrey is an economics professor at the University of Southern California.
The idea of an alternative minimum tax is to have a parallel tax system to ensure that profitable corporations pay at least some tax.
Some, as in 20%, the current corporate AMT rate. If the tax is repealed, as the House proposes, that could mean a loss of $40 billion in revenue over 10 years. Gordon Gray at the American Action Forum says the Senate's decision to keep the AMT came down to dollars and cents.
We have X number of dollars that we can spend to make other deals. Okay, fine, we'll lose the AMT repeal, but the final product, at least with that little wrinkle in there, isn't particularly coherent policy.
Because congressional Republicans propose slashing the normal corporate tax rate to 20%. Keeping both rates at 20% means the AMT would become the default corporate tax rate for many companies. Jennifer McCluskey at the Information Technology Industry Council says that's especially troubling for the tech sector.
This new policy would be like a full repeal of the research and development tax credit.
These R&D credits amount to hundreds of millions of dollars. McCluskey says they're crucial to the U.S. tech sector's ability to innovate and compete globally, and groups like hers have lobbied hard to make them permanent.
We are very optimistic that this problem will get solved because there are just so many friends of the R&D credit in Congress.
To make tech companies happy, the Senate could take the House approach and repeal the AMT, or keep it but cut it. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Two more things before we go. Number one, instead of us telling you what we think matters about the tax bill, why don't you tell us what you want to hear about the tax bill? Hit us up on Twitter. The show is at Marketplace. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. We'll figure out a way to do as much as we can of your suggestions. Item number two, and completely unrelated, we are 3 days from a government shutdown, gang. Didn't want that to get lost in translation. On Wall Street today, no siree, Bob. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Innovation is one of those economic buzzwords you hear all the time. So much so, maybe, that it loses some of its impact. But some new work from Stanford economist Raj Chetty about who gets to be innovative in this economy is pretty sobering. Professor Chetty, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kai.
This is going to sound like a basic question, but I need to start with you helping me understand why innovation matters in an economy.
Well, innovation is really the source of economic growth, the discovery of new technologies, discovery of new drugs, things that make our lives better, things that ultimately allow us to be much more productive, for example, computers or the internet or the Industrial Revolution. All of that is at the heart of why human beings today in the U.S. and most other developed countries live much better lives, much richer lives, much longer lives than they did in the past.
And what we have here in this paper, most recently from you and your colleagues, is, in essence, the absence of innovation because of inequality, right?
The paper is about what we call lost Einsteins, a large set of people who we think could have become highly impactful innovators, people who could have discovered the next iPhone, the next blockbuster drug. But because they didn't have the right opportunities, the right background, because they were kids from minority families or low-income families or women, they ended up not coming through the innovation pipeline. And as a result, we have less innovation than we could.
It's also a geographic disparity, right? Kids from the South aren't listed in this paper, really?
There are sharp geographic disparities, and what that goes to is one of the key explanations for why we see these lost Einsteins. It really seems to be about exposure to innovation while you're growing up. So if you grow up in an area like Silicon Valley, for example, where there's a lot of innovation going on, you're much more likely to become an inventor yourself. In the South, what's interesting is in general, we don't see many kids that are growing up to become inventors. One exception to that is Austin, Texas, which, as you know, especially recently, has really become a hub of innovation.
And this, I mean, you did the regression analyses or whatever econometrics you did, and you segregated out for income levels and all of that stuff, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Let me give you a concrete example of how we do that. It's actually quite simple. We look at the exact technology category in which people are innovating. And what you find is it's not just that people innovate more when they grow up around inventors. It's that the specific type of innovation they do is greatly influenced by who they grew up around. An additional dimension that I think is extremely important is that these effects vary by gender. So it turns out that women tend to patent in exactly the categories that the women around them were inventing in. So if you grew up in an area where women were innovating a lot in a particular technology, you're more likely to do that yourself. Meanwhile, boys are much more influenced by men. So it's a very particular pattern by gender as well in terms of exposure.
Yeah, so let's move on, because that's where I was going to go, actually, is let's move on to the solution of this, right? Because, you know, should we get more women into typically male fields? I mean, what is the answer, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, so our sense is if we could bring in this pool of women, kids from low-income families, and minorities, we would have four times as much innovation in the U.S. as we currently do. So there are big stakes here. Now, the question is, how do you actually go about doing that? What I think you really need is to change the environments, the childhood environments of these kids. And usually when people talk about childhood environment, they mean things like improving schools, improving neighborhoods, reducing segregation, things like that. And I think all of that could matter. But there's also something much more specific here that I think could really matter, which is creating more opportunities for exposure and innovation for kids who are very talented, excelling in math and science at early ages. And then you have systematic programs to connect them with people from similar backgrounds who've become inventors. I think you really need a role model that you can see yourself in that person's shoes. That's the type of program I think could be effective here if done at scale.
Raj Chetty, professor of economics at Stanford University. The project he works on is called the Equality of Opportunity Project. Professor Chetty, thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you, Kai.
We're going to put the extended play version of that interview on the podcast that Molly Wood and I do. It is called Make Me Smart. It's on the episode that comes out today. Before we do today's numbers, here's a tip for you. For as little as $5 a month, please consider signing up as a Marketplace investor. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. You might not know that we're a nonprofit news organization, one that's on a mission to increase economic intelligence all across this country. It's important work that we're already doing, and with your help, we'll do more of it and reach more people as well. You can donate today at marketplace.org, and thanks. Coming up.
He wanted to be shown as a working man because he believed that the working men of this country were the honest people of the country.
We take a break from audio to look at some pictures, kind of. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 109 today, 0.4%, 24,180. The NASDAQ off 13 points, about a 0.1%, 67.62. The S&P 500 off 9 points, 0.3%, 26.29. The airline industry's top trade group said earnings for carriers are set to beat expectations this year. One big reason, increased cargo in the form of online purchases. Still, American Airlines dropped 0.9%, Delta down 0.9% as well. Speaking of online shopping, by the way, cyber retailers continue to report strong sales of holiday goods. Amazon up 0.6% today, Walmart up 0.8%. Bonds up as well, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. The history of Ireland and Northern Ireland is complicated and not usually economic in nature. Religious mostly, political quite often, and always quite prickly. We're talking about it here, though, because it has become economic and the latest hiccup in Brexit negotiations. The issue is the border between the British province of Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic
in the south. Ireland, the Irish Republic, backed by the rest of the European Union, of which it is a member, is demanding that the Brits give a written guarantee right now that after Brexit, the border, the UK's only land border with an EU country, is going to stay as open as it is today. No easy feat, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains from the European desk.
Combilift is an Irish company that makes forklift trucks at a site not far from the border with Northern Ireland. It's doing well and expanding, but sales director Anthony Rooney is worried that Brexit will affect the free flow of goods across that border.
There's a huge cloud in this area around Brexit. We're a huge importer and exporter of product to the UK. We rely on the UK as our home market. We need to make that movement of product as easy as it is currently in today's market.
Many businesses feel the same on the other side of the border in Northern Ireland. Belcas, one of Britain's biggest timber companies, processes logs mainly shipped up from the Irish Republic in the south. Its profitability depends on working around the clock. Put checkpoints and customs posts in the way, says boss Brian Murphy, and margins will suffer.
Now, we have 23,000 cross-border commercial lorry movements every year. If we lost an hour a day, or an hour on each truck movement, the efficiency of the business will be badly impaired.
This could be a matter not just of prosperity, but of peace. There's a fear that a hard border could reignite the violent struggle between those in Northern Ireland who want the province to be united with the Irish Republic and those who want it to remain part of the UK. That conflict was formally ended with a peace agreement on Good Friday in 1998. Irish Senator Gerard Crochwell.
It guarantees that there will be no border, that there will be freedom of movement between north and south. So if we're to maintain the Good Friday Agreement, there cannot be a border.
Everyone agrees that there shouldn't be a border, but the two sides can't agree on how to avoid one after Brexit. Yesterday, the EU and Britain had apparently struck a deal. The British government accepted that Northern Ireland would maintain what it called regulatory alignment with the Irish Republic, while Britain makes its own rules after it leaves the EU. But that provoked this angry reaction from Arlene Foster, leader of Northern Ireland's Democratic Unionist Party.
We will not accept any form of regulatory divergence which separates Northern Ireland economically or politically from the rest of the UK, and the economic and constitutional integrity of the United Kingdom must not be compromised.
Foster can't be ignored. Her party's 10 lawmakers are key parliamentary partners with the British government. If she withdraws her support, the government will likely fall. But the Irish Republic, fully backed by the EU, is standing firm. Stephen Donnelly of Ireland's opposition Fianna Fáil party says virtually all Irish lawmakers agree there must be no hard border between the north and south after Brexit.
That simply can't be countenanced. There's just too much at stake. The potential damage to the north, and indeed to parts of Ireland, the potential damage is catastrophic.
This is what a real deadlock looks like. And there's a deadline too. If British Prime Minister Theresa May is to have any hope of delivering a smooth Brexit on schedule, she'll have to crack this conundrum by the end of this week. At the European desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
I was in Washington last week, did a couple of interviews, also took a swing by the National Portrait Gallery, where there's a new exhibition called The Sweat of Their Face Portraying American Workers. It's a combination of art and history and the realities of some of the people who helped make this economy go from the 18th century up to today. I got a walking tour with Dorothy Moss. She's the gallery's curator of painting and sculpture. And I started with the basic idea of what work is in this country.
It's so interesting because you come to today's world and what we do for a living somehow defines us, right? I mean, the first thing you say when you meet somebody is, what do you do?
Exactly.
You know?
Yes. And it's interesting in a museum of portraiture where identity is our focus, that we have not really made an effort to show working Americans in portraiture, and we've realized in the process of putting this exhibition together how difficult it is to go back in time and look for portraits that conform to the formal academic conventions of portraiture when looking at images of workers.
Was it actually difficult to go back and find the pictures and the images? Is that what you're saying?
It was sometimes challenging because a lot of these people are unnamed that are in the portrayals. And so they, you know, weren't the people who had access to the elite activity of portrait making. But artists have always been drawn to workers because artists identify as workers most of the time.
All right, show me some of your favorites or some of the of the important ones here, I guess.
We begin the exhibition with John Nagle's portrait of Pat Lyon at the Forge, which was borrowed from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts. John Nagle actually made multiple versions of this painting. This one was done in 1829 and was commissioned by Pat Lyon when he had become a successful businessman and could afford to have his portrait made.
His own portrait, right?
And, and he asked to be shown as a working man. He had begun as a blacksmith and was accused of robbing a bank, and he had not done that. And so he was thrown in jail for 3 months. And when he was able to have a portrait made, he wanted to be shown as a working man because he believed that the working men of this country were the honest people of the country.
It's not to be cynical, but he's polishing up his own image here, right?
Exactly, yes.
And I mean, this is a biggie, right? He's life-size, if not bigger.
Well, this breaks the boundaries of portraiture in many ways to show a working-class person
full body,
full length,
in front of the Forge.
In a large scale. This rivals the size of the portrait of George Washington by Gilbert Stuart that is just down the hall in our America's Presidents Gallery.
Okay, where are we off to?
Another portrait from the mid-19th century is by a woman artist, Lily Martin Spencer, who was so successful that her husband, who worked as a tailor, stopped his work to manage her career. Her portraits of women in domestic settings were popular and highly reproduced. This is a portrait of Jane Thompson, her own maid, looking out at the artist with a smile on her face, a twinkle in her eyes. Again, it breaks all boundaries of traditional academic portraiture in terms of that toothy smile and animated expression.
You know, it's interesting, though, and we'll see some others later that are much more serious and subdued in their representation of the work that's being done, but I'm going to bet you that smile was not actually on her face when she was doing all that laundry in 1859.
It's a bit ironic
scrubbing them on the washer tub,
to show someone hard at work with a smile on their face.
Yeah, doing somebody else's laundry.
Right.
I wonder if, as you look at this exhibition in its totality, whether we have a false romanticism about labor in this country. I mean, you know, it's hard day's work and day's work for a day's wages, but it has been, and in many cases is still today, just brutal to be
work
a laborer
is hard.
In this economy.
Yeah. Work is hard, and I think we can tend to heroicize workers, romanticize workers, but the artist whose work is in this exhibition exposed the truths of the difficulty of labor and the resilience of the people who toil and who, you know, have built this country, but who are often unrecognized, whose names do not get attached to their work.
Yeah.
But who many of us look to as our, you know, ancestors, who are the people who made the lives for us that we live.
The space in this gallery is short, right? And you have to allocate your resources. Why this exhibit now in a big exhibition?
Well, it takes us quite a long time to plan exhibitions. So this has been in the works for the last 5 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's mostly a loan exhibition, so negotiating loans from other institutions and private collections, putting together the catalog takes that long. But the seed for this was planted when I was writing my dissertation, and I read a story that was published in 1897 in the New York Times about a plumber who had come into the Metropolitan Museum of Art on a break from a job on Park Avenue, and he was asked to leave because he looked disorderly. He was in his work clothes. And stories about that incident ran in papers across the country all the way to Montana, with critics saying, who are the art institutions of this country for? They're being funded mostly by taxpayers' dollars. So who has the right to enjoy the spaces, to enjoy the collections? And should there be this kind of hierarchy of behavior and dress associated with the sacred spaces of the art museum?
What do you want the average person who comes in and says, let me go to the National Portrait Gallery today? What do you want him or her to get out of this?
I want people to walk away from this exhibition with a sense of the worker as a strong individual who is contributing to this country daily. I want people to walk away recognizing workers in their daily life. I want people to come and identify with what they see on the wall, to find a connection to your own story, your family's history, and possibly feel a little less alone walking away.
Dorothy, thanks.
Thank you so much.
This is, if I'm being completely honest, one of those radio interviews that needs a little visual to make it work better. We put pictures of some of the portraits that Dorothy Moss and I were talking about on our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. This final note on the way out today, cautionary tale edition. Today in 1996, a guy by the name of Alan Greenspan, maybe you've heard of him, he gave a speech entitled The Challenge of Central Banking in a Democratic Society, an otherwise unremarkable talk, except for this bit.
But how do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values, which then become subject to unexpected and prolonged contractions?
He was talking about Japan there, but hey, with the markets where they are right now, don't forget your history, y'all. All right, we got to go down all the way around on Wall Street today. Not a whole lot, though. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is our executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.